"Scott, you have to leave and check into rehab," I said. "I'm not going to rehab," he said. "Then you just have to leave." "Leave? What do you mean by leave?" Chapter 39. I forbade Scott from having dinner with us that night. I told him to order room service if he wanted, but when we came back to the hotel room, he needed to be gone. "Where will I sleep tonight?" he asked. "I don't know." "Dad, you're forcing me to sleep on the street." "No, Scott, you're forcing yourself to sleep on the street." "How can you kick me out?" "You are killing everybody around you. I can't save you from yourself, but I can save them from you." "I'm not going to rehab, Dad." "Then it's time to say goodbye." "I love you, Scott. I will miss you. And if anything happens to you, I may hate myself for the rest of my life. Goodbye." "Goodbye, Dad." But when we returned from dinner, Scott was still in our room. "I'll go to rehab," he said. The next morning, I learned that the most highly regarded rehab was City Team in downtown San Jose. There was a 5-month waiting list. However, a close friend knew someone on the board and made a phone call that got Scott into the program within a week. Scott settled into a routine and spoke well of the place, especially of the director who had contracted malaria while he served as a missionary in Africa and couldn't wait to go back. At the end of his first month at City Team, Scott met a lawyer's daughter in a convenience store. She picked him up in his free time and drove him around town in her BMW. Scott called me right about the time he completed his first 60 days in the program. "My girlfriend rented a room for us in San Francisco for the weekend," he said. "Do you think it's okay if I go?" "No, Scott, it's not okay," I said. "You're supposed to concentrate on getting and staying clean." "I need a break." "City Team won't give you permission to shack up with a girl for the weekend. They don't have to know." "Scott, they are experts at detecting lies. They will find out and they will kick you out." "Okay, Dad." I never found out if Scott took the girl up on her offer. But I don't think he was really asking for my advice. He wanted his dad to know that he still excelled at the one thing he had always been good at. Or maybe he wanted to erase any doubts that he might be gay. Although Scott often criticized the church for its hypocrisy and legalism, that never stopped people in the church from reaching out to him. I had close friends in the area, Dick and Carla Bernal, who pastored a large church in San Jose, Rich and Wilma Marshall, who pastored a church in Sunnyvale. Dick's wife, Carla, picked Scott up at City Team and took him to church and to lunch afterwards. Brian, one of the youth workers at the Sunnyvale church, visited Scott at City Team and took him to dinner and the movies. At City Team, Scott had been given the task of manning the front desk, but he often charmed or fooled someone else into doing it for him. When that didn't work, he didn't show up. Once again, he depleted all his goodwill and the other residents voted him out. Scott spent Saturday night on the street. On Sunday morning, he loitered around the back of the Sunnyvale sanctuary. A woman named Nancy Duarte saw him, tapped her husband Mark on the arm and said, "I don't know who that kid is, but he is special." The couple was in their early 30s and owned a growing design firm. The youth worker who took Scott to the movies was Mark Duarte's brother-in-law. After the worship service was over, Brian asked Mark if Scott could stay at his home for the weekend. "Yes," Mark said. That weekend turned into a year. Mark and Nancy weren't looking to adopt. Their daughter Rachel was 15. Their son Anthony was 12. But in Scott, they saw the same thing that many others had, a lost boy who could become great if he could feel loved and find structure. They enrolled him in college, bought him a cell phone, and gave him his own room. Night terrors visited Scott almost every night, dreams of people chasing him and trying to kill him. He told Mark he was terrified that he would die young. In the evenings, Mark played the guitar and sang worship songs as Scott lay on the floor and stretched his hands toward heaven as if he were drowning and hoping to be rescued. Scott got a job at Starbucks in downtown Mountain View, where he met his best friend, Sergio. When the line of customers stretched to the front door, Scott and Sergio became flamboyant speed baristas, tossing cups to each other and grinding beans and pulling shots faster than anyone had ever seen. As the line dissipated, their audience burst into applause. "Dad, two beautiful young married women in their 20s who come into Starbucks every day ask me to sleep with them together. What do you think? Scott, that is a crazy proposition. Don't do it. But, Dad, two women in bed with you? That's every guy's dream. That's not my dream. It could be your nightmare if their husbands come after you. One night, Scott thought the Duartes would be gone for the whole evening, and he invited a girl over. He was having sex with her on the diving board of the pool when he heard Mark and Nancy drive up. He shooed the girl out the back gate and ran into the house wrapped in a towel. They figured Scott had gone for an evening swim. In July 1998, the throat cancer that my hunting partner Terry had beaten 5 years earlier came back. I prayed and fasted for him. I took him and Vanessa to a conference so gifted healers could pray for him. I thought God would heal him. He was a great husband. He was the hero of his boys. He loved Jesus. But the cancer ignored the goodness of my friend and defied our prayers. The tumor on the side of his larynx grew, crushing his voice box. Swallowing became difficult. Terry lost weight. That fall, the mass had broken through the skin on his neck, oozing pus. He wore a bandana around his throat, as his mayor carried him through the mountain forest. As I rode behind him, the stench of his decaying throat floated on the wind. In January 1999, Vanessa took Terry to a group of Christians in Connecticut to pray nonstop for his healing. She brought his body home in a white cardboard coffin. I wasn't ready to give up. We placed the coffin in a small room and removed the lid. The plastic body bag was transparent. Terry wore the clothes he had died in. I could see his face. The plastic dulled his features. He looked like he was asleep. Then 10 of us took turns gathering around the coffin, laying our hands on his body, and asking God to raise him up. After a couple of hours of impotent praying, my faith ran out. As I walked out of the room, I stared at a young widow and her three fatherless boys, and I wondered why my prayers were the most powerless for the people I loved the most. I silently vowed to look after Vanessa and her boys until it was clear that God had sent someone to take over Terry's role. I presided over Terry's funeral service before a large crowd in Bozeman on February 7, 1999. Scott made some A's at Foothill Community College in the fall of 1998, and the Duartes took not only Scott, but Lisa and me as well, to Maui for a week in February 1999. We ate lobster and steak and drank great Cabernets every night. We went whale watching and snorkeling during the day. I swam beside Scott in the ocean 15 feet below the surface to the turtles lying on the sandy bottom. A nearby sign read, "Don't touch the turtles." Scott swam to the biggest turtle, grabbed the back of its shell, and rode it all the way up to the surface. I had not seen him this happy or grateful in the last 10 years. I was certain he was on the path toward recovery and that God had used the Duartes to save our son. After a great year at the Duartes, Scott smoked pot again and used other drugs and broke all the rules. Rachel was confident and sassy like Nancy. She joked that she and Scott had a love-hate relationship. Scott loved her, she hated him. It was a joke, but she resented Scott for diverting so much of her parents' time and emotional energy to him. Whenever Nancy confronted Scott, he argued with her and sometimes reduced her to tears. He took it for granted that she had rescued him off the streets and gave him his own room in her beautiful home. After living with the Duartes for about 8 months, he seemed to have realized he had crossed lines. "I just wanted to check in with you and see if everything is okay between us," Scott wrote to Nancy in an email. "And lately you seem kind of mad at me still. Or maybe just not interested. Or in other words, do you still love me?" Of course Nancy still loved him, but she was also exhausted by him. At some point, Scott forced everyone who loved him to love him from a distance. The pain of being close to him was too intense. "I'm not ignoring you, and yes, I still love you," Nancy wrote back. "I just don't have much to say to you, that's all. It's hard to have a conversation with you or in front of you because of the comments you make. So I limit my speech to only the necessities to avoid pain. As far as my love goes, that runs deep and true. Part of my pain is that I'm concerned. I solicit advice, I pray, I worry, I cry, and I'm tired. The responsibility of your life and success in many ways has shifted to us somehow. We are praying long and hard about what the next phase of your life should entail." She went on to complain that he had left food out in the kitchen, drove their truck when he wasn't supposed to, and stayed up so late that he often missed the classes they had paid for. Mark called me to let me know that my son was putting him in a position of having to choose between Scott and his wife. "Scott not only breaks the rules," Mark said, "but he disrespects Nancy. If she thinks I'll choose him over my wife, he's crazy." When I called Scott to warn him, he said, "Dad, Mark would never ask me to leave." But Mark did just that. By midsummer of 2000, Scott had run out of people to charm. He slept in a garage with a dog. I talked to Scott every couple of days, and he always told me how miserable it was sleeping in the garage. It killed me that my son was living like an animal, but I didn't tell him that. Instead, I said, "Scott, if you don't stop the drugs, that garage will seem like the Ritz-Carlton compared to the next place you'll sleep." I went to visit him in July. We stood in the parking lot of the Stanford Mall in Palo Alto. "Scott, God really loves you," I said. He looked down at the asphalt and muttered, "God loves everybody." "No, Scott," I said, "you are really special to God." "Everybody's special to God," he said. I could offer Scott the knowledge of God, but not the experience of God. And knowledge alone could not penetrate the Kevlar vest of shame wrapped around his heart. I sighed and gave up trying to convince him. In the mid-1990s, I read an article about a Dell janitor retiring with $9 million worth of stock. If a janitor could make that kind of money, couldn't I? I talked it over with Benny, and we both began studying the stock market, especially tech stocks that outperformed all the other stocks. We found a broker in town who had made millions. Benny was rich and had plenty to invest. I put all our savings into the market and borrowed more on margin to invest in a sure thing. On some days, I made more than what was once my annual salary. At our workouts, Benny and I had talked about God and the church. Now neither of us went to church, and the market's performance dominated our conversations. We not only bored, but also irritated our weightlifting partners. I wrote another book. It was about hearing God's voice. I traveled the world speaking for God, and yet his importance in my life waned. I had more money than ever. I wasn't just smart anymore, I was rich too. As whitefish thawed in the spring of 2000, I drove down the mountain from my home to meet Benny at the gym. By summer, I could cash out of the market and never have to work again. Then I heard the from out of nowhere voice. "Sell everything," it said. I knew it was God's voice. My voice would never have told me to sell everything. It made no sense to sell everything when each day my portfolio was growing in value. I should have listened. Instead, I told myself that God surely didn't mean for me to sell everything right now, not until I had just a little more. A few days later, the NASDAQ Composite Index peaked at 5,132 points. Then tech stocks plummeted. "Don't panic," my investment advisor said. "It's only a small correction. It had to happen at some point." I hoped they were right. When I looked at my portfolio, I felt less rich and not so smart. By August, I was down almost 50%. I still had plenty of money on paper, and the brokers still told me to be calm. That same August, as I drove down my mountain, once again I heard the voice that would have made me rich if I had heeded it. "Bring Scott home," it said. "Treat him like the prodigal who has returned home, but know that he has not returned home." I'm so grateful that I listened. I hopped on a plane to Mountain View to rescue Scott from the garage. "Scott, why don't you come back to Whitefish with me for a few weeks, and we'll bow hunt for whitetail and elk starting September 1st, I said. He loved the idea. We had a great time climbing through the forest with bows slung over our shoulders, and in mid-September I suggested that he move back to Montana. "We can hunt all fall," I said. "I'll get you an apartment in Bozeman. I'll get you a car. You can go back to college at Montana State in January, and I'll pay your bills while you're in college." "That sounds great, Dad," he said. In the fall of 2000, I hunted all over Montana with my hunting partners. I was the only father who brought his son on every trip. We climbed up mountains, hiked through fields, traipsed through the snow in search of elk, antelope, deer, pheasants, and ducks. I put Scott in an apartment with Terry's son, Brandon, in Bozeman. I bought Scott a new four-wheel drive Chevy Silverado pickup. He was accepted into Montana State for the next semester beginning in January 2001. He got a job at a coffee shop in Bozeman and waited to restart college. For the first time in 22 years, we didn't just talk, we communicated. One afternoon between hunting trips, I sat with him in our living room. He was on one side of the fireplace, and I was on the other. The two big elk mounts looked down on us from their place high above the mantel. As the flames crackled, I remembered my violent reaction to Scott cursing his mom. The weight of what I had done seemed heavier than ever. I had never even asked him for forgiveness. "Scott," I said, "you've heard me tell the story of how my father showed me grace when I called my mom a damn shittin' rat." "Dad," he said, "it's okay." "It's not okay. You were only 13. "Dad, it's okay." "Scott, I have committed many sins in my life, and of all of them, that is the one I most wish I could take back. I failed you, Scott. If I could have just taken you by the hand and led you back to your mom to tell her you didn't mean it, she would have hugged you. Instead of bringing God's love to you, I brought shame and terror. And by the time I realized what I had done, you had already left home. I am so sorry. I am so sorry that it's taken me all these years to apologize. Dad, I know it's okay." I couldn't tell if the apology meant anything to him or not. In mid-December, Vanessa called to say she was worried that Scott was drinking too much. The police had found him at 4 a.m., passed out in his pickup. The windows were rolled down, and the temperature had approached zero. The newspaper published an item in its crime log but didn't mention Scott's name. A psychiatrist in Bozeman had diagnosed him as bipolar and prescribed lithium for him. When he came home that Christmas, I didn't see any signs of depression. We talked about the upcoming school year and what he needed for his apartment. One evening, Scott pulled into the driveway in his new pickup with a dented front bumper. He told me he hit a piece of furniture that had fallen off from someone's trailer. I knew it was a lie. We didn't find out until years later that 2 days before Christmas, Scott had driven out into the middle of a frozen lake. He sat in his truck, waiting for the ice to crack. Chapter 40. On December 26, 2000, Scott drove south on Highway 90 to Kalispell with a lease to go to the movies. Snow and ice covered the road, but Scott pressed the accelerator to the floor. When the speedometer cracked 85 miles per hour, Elise wanted to caution Scott. But she recognized the clouds that had settled in around him. If she spoke up, he would only have driven faster. That night he left with Benny's daughter, Cassie, around 9. I told him goodbye, not knowing when he might return home. I went to sleep upstairs around 11 p.m. Sometime before dawn, a burst of noise jostled me out of a deep sleep. What was that? I listened for a few more seconds and then put my head back down on the pillow. I woke up at 7 a.m., made an espresso, and started a fire. I sank into the same chair in which I had apologized to Scott and worked on my next book. Before long, Stephen woke up and went upstairs to my office to surf the Internet. When he came to the kitchen for another cup of coffee, he asked if Elise was working out on the treadmill. He heard a beeping sound from Scott's bedroom, where we had placed our treadmill. I told him I would check. When I opened the door, it took my mind a few seconds to unscramble the details. There was my son, fully clothed, sitting on the floor with his back against the foot of the bed. Did he pass out before he could get into bed? Why was there glass on the floor? Oh, no, blood. He must have fallen and cut himself. Then the silver sheen of a gun barrel caught my eye. His right hand clutched my .44 Magnum revolver. His left hand still clung to a broken beer bottle. Scott! His name emerged from my throat involuntarily. Partly a wail, partly a plea. He did not move. I rushed to him, knelt beside him, and tossed the gun out of his reach. For a moment, I was alone with this awful knowledge. Soon I wouldn't be. And what then? How would his mother survive? How would I go on? I was at the border of a new world that was darker and more unforgiving than any other I had known. I looked at the gun. "Use it," I heard a voice say. "It's the only way." Instead, I stood up. I shouted downstairs to Stephen, "Call 911. Scott shot himself." "What?" he yelled back, confused. He raced toward Scott's room, and we passed each other on the stairs. Inside the room, Stephen picked up the gun and opened the cylinder, which contained only one shell case. 5 unspent bullets lay between Scott's legs. After calling 911, I returned to Scott's body. He was playing Russian roulette, Stephen said. We could hear Elise moving around downstairs. Stephen went to find her to keep her from stumbling onto the scene, cold. On his way out, he rammed his fist through the sheetrock. He was furious at his brother. Scott didn't just kill himself, he thought. He probably just killed his father and mother. That's a hell of a way to punctuate all the pain he caused them. I woke up Lisa. I told her what had happened. "Please don't go in there," I said. "If you don't let me go to Scott," she said, "I will never forgive you." I put my white robe on her and led her to him. We gathered around Scott's body. I held Scott's head, putting my hand over the exit wound so my wife wouldn't see it. We asked God to bring him back from the dead. "Give him one more chance, please." While we prayed, Lisa thought of all the prayers she had prayed for Scott. "The joke's on you now," she thought. "Some mother you turned out to be." Demons danced on decades of pleas uttered for her second-born son, a boy deeply loved, but now forever lost. The police arrived and asked us to leave. We headed downstairs, but then I looked at my hands. Lisa followed me back up to our bathroom. As I ran my hands under the faucet, we stared wordlessly at the sink as Scott's blood, skin, and brain tissue disappeared down the drain. Chapter 41. As the police pieced together the last moments of his life, we called our closest whitefish friends. Benny showed up within a few moments. He threw his arms around me and cried. He said Cassie had told him that Scott had bought drugs at a bar last night. She didn't know what the substance was. For the next few hours, Scott had faded in and out of consciousness. She had left him around 2 a.m. Two other couples showed up to comfort us, and when the police left, the phone rang nonstop. Among the first to call were our oldest and best friends from Fort Worth, John and Nancy Snyder, who had helped us start Christ Chapel. "Jackie, you come home right now," Nancy said. "You will stay with us. We will take care of you." Home. I didn't know where that was anymore. Our Montana dream home had become a house of horror. We could no longer stand to be there. We checked into a lodge a mile and a half down the road. I didn't eat anything the whole day. That night, I took a bite of a sandwich and then threw it away. Eating was a betrayal of love. How could I enjoy food on the day my son had killed himself? I tried to eat breakfast the next morning, but I could not tolerate the holiday laughter in the lodge's crowded restaurant. 3 days later, 4 seats opened up on a flight to Texas. Back in Fort Worth, Nancy opened her front door and said, "You take that side, we'll take this side, and we'll grow old together." Lisa crumpled into Nancy's arms. Even though we were in a safe place, I could not make decisions. I let others pick out Scott's coffin and decide who would speak at his funeral. At the service, the 4 preachers to whom I was the closest spoke. But it was hardly a eulogy. Scott's friends from California hated what was said. They thought the speakers emphasized his dark side and ignored everything that made him so lovable. The service ended with an invitation for Scott's non-believing friends to come down to the front and give their hearts to Jesus. I would have balked at giving the altar call at a funeral. Nevertheless, dozens of young people came forward. Scott's friend Sergio threw himself on the coffin. At that very moment, the sun broke through an opening in the overcast sky and sent a ray of sunlight through the round balcony window onto Sergio's head. He turned to look at the light, and his face and tears were radiant. The crowd gasped. We buried Scott on January 2, 2001. As Lisa cried herself to sleep that night, she said, "I can't believe Scott's in the ground." I held on to her and said, "Honey, our bodies come from dust and then go to dust. We will see Scott again." The next morning, on the front page of the metro section of the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, the headline read, "Dust to Dust." It was an article about the destruction of the 67-year-old Belknap Viaduct on the eastern edge of downtown. A few days later, a thunderstorm hit in the middle of the night, and Lisa woke up, terrified that Scott was shivering in his coffin. "Honey, he's not in his coffin. He's in heaven. He's praying for us now." "I know. I just don't want him to be cold. The ground is so cold and wet. But he's not in the ground. I know. It's just so cold. I can't help it." The night that Nancy Duarte came home to California from Scott's funeral in Fort Worth, she dreamed she was sleeping and heard someone talking in her bathroom. Still in the dream, she got up out of bed and walked into the bathroom. Scott stood in the corner of the bathroom, talking on his cell phone. "Yeah, I did that," she heard him say. "I just have one more thing to do, and I'll be there." Nancy knew he was talking to God. Scott hung up. They walked to each other and hugged. Nancy could smell his musty smell, the nicotine mixed with his Calvin Klein cologne. Both of them cried, and he asked her to deliver a message. "Tell Rachel that I know she loved me." Then Nancy woke up. That morning, Nancy sat with Rachel at the kitchen island. Rachel felt guilty for giving Scott such a hard time when he was alive. Nancy told her about the dream. "It was so real that I could smell him and feel him," Nancy said. "It didn't feel like a dream. He told me to tell you that he knows you loved him." Rachel broke down in tears. While we were still at John and Nancy's, I received an email from a reader. In one of my books, I wrote about my conviction that I would be reunited with Dad in heaven. I don't think the man knew about Scott's death. He just wanted to correct me. "Suicides don't go to heaven," he wrote. "They can't confess their last sin. When the devil wants to send a message, he can always find a religious person to deliver it with perfect timing." But it didn't work. I had become a Christian 35 years earlier, and at my moment of belief, the idea of St. Peter's scales was forever banished, at least as far as salvation was concerned. Perhaps the only thing of which I was still certain was that no one gains eternal life through good works. It is through faith in Jesus alone, and once he is in our heart, he never leaves. We can't possibly be aware of all of our sins, let alone confess them all. Scott's belongings arrived in a wardrobe box, the kind that movers use when they pack up closets. Everything Scott owned fit in three small duffel bags and one small box. When Lisa found some of Scott's unwashed clothes, she put his black shirt to her face and inhaled. I could smell the nicotine. "Honey, I'll wash those clothes," I said. "No," she shouted. "I don't want to lose his smell." I watched Lisa cling to the last physical scraps of her son on earth, and I feared for our future. She held on through her senses. I let go through my mind. I hated the amnesia of sleep. I woke up free for a few seconds each morning, and then learned I was in an endless nightmare. Although I believed in a God who heals, I couldn't believe that my soul would ever be healed. Once my life had a lofty purpose, to speak to churches and write books about God's goodness so that people would want a deeper relationship with Jesus Christ. But Scott's death robbed me of the story I had told myself to make sense of my life. I had nowhere to go and nothing to do. I still got out of bed at dawn, but I didn't know why. A couple of weeks after the funeral, someone suggested we go out for an evening. I didn't want to, but I told my family I thought maybe we should. We had almost made it through dinner when Lisa broke down. She was so sorry, she said. She didn't want to spoil things. She would try to sit through the movie, but nobody wanted to watch a movie, so we headed home. I stopped at a convenience store. I saw an old friend flipping through the magazines. He had recently lost his wife, Deborah, to colon cancer. He told me he was writing a book about his life with her. He wasn't a writer, he was an art dealer. I thought the book would go nowhere. The book, same kind of different as me, would make the New York Times bestseller list and become a movie with A-list stars. As Ron and I talked for a few minutes, I noticed that the mischievous sparkle had left his eyes. His voice was flat. He talked about death in the analytical tones of a medical examiner. He came out of the car to say hi to my family. He took one look at Lisa and said, "You all aren't even out of shock yet." Later that night, Lisa told me she couldn't go on. All she ever wanted to be was a wife and mother. Now 22 years of prayers and mothering had disappeared with the pull of a trigger. I pointed out how much joy Stephen and Elise had given us. "We still have them," I said. Her despair lifted momentarily. Then she said that Stephen and Elise had turned out good in spite of her. Hurling logic at Lisa's shame turned out to be as helpful as throwing rocks at the devil. Still, I tried to save Lisa by becoming a student of her grief. I took notes every day about anything, a song, a smell, a sight that triggered a memory that turned into tears. Like when in the supermarket one day, she saw a young boy Scott's height and build with a baseball cap turned backwards. 2 weeks after we buried him, the funeral bill arrived. It was $10,064.69. 30 minutes later, my secretary walked into the room with a sack of mail. I dumped out 38 sympathy cards and letters, which contained 22 checks, one for each year of Scott's life. I added them up. The total was $10,065, a few pennies above the cost of putting his body in the ground. I was stunned. I didn't need the money. I still had plenty in the bank to pay for Scott's funeral. "What are you saying, God?" I asked. The voice of mercy, the voice I had ignored for money, spoke to me through money. It said, "I paid for his death. I also paid for his life. And I'll pay for everything you need as long as you live." That February, a church in Amarillo, Texas, that I spoke at once a month, needed me to introduce a special speaker at their weekend services because all their senior pastors were out of town. So I left Lisa in the care of Stephen and Elise for 24 hours. It was my first time in a church service since I'd lost Scott 8 weeks earlier. After the service ended, I stood at the front of the church with the prayer team. I spotted someone moving toward me. I couldn't tell if the person was a man or woman, a girl or boy. The person did not have a face. Where the mouth should have been was a misshapen hole, and what was once a nose was no longer recognizable as a nose. The blind eyes were slits sealed shut. A plastic tube protruded from a hole in the throat, a permanent tracheostomy. An attractive blonde woman led him by the arm. "Hi, I'm Michelle," she said. "This is my son, Aaron." 6 months ago, Aaron was so distraught that he put a shotgun under his chin and pulled the trigger. The blast blew away his face. It has taken multiple surgeries to get him to this place. He doesn't believe in God, but he came down here with me because I asked him to. Would you pray for Aaron? The last time I laid hands on a person in prayer was when I held Scott's head and asked God to bring him back from the dead. "Aaron, my name is Jack," I said. "Would you like me to pray for you?" He put his finger over the tube to keep the air from escaping before it could go through his vocal folds and said, "Yes." I put my right hand on his back. When my left hand touched his heart, power fell on me. It rippled down my neck, down my back, down my legs. I knew what to pray. "Aaron," I said, "my 22-year-old son, Scott, pulled the trigger at Christmas, but he didn't make it. God spared your life because he still has purposes for you if you want to fulfill them." "I'm so sorry," said Michelle. "I didn't know. I heard about the minister whose son, whose son, I didn't know it was you. I'm just so sorry. I would never have brought my son to you if..." "Michelle, don't be sorry. You haven't done anything wrong. I'm glad you came to me. I'm glad to pray for Aaron. God made this appointment between us," I said. I finished praying for Aaron. Then I prayed for Michelle and felt the same power descend on me. After they walked away, I couldn't tell who had benefited more from the encounter, Aaron or me. I looked up and offered a silent, spontaneous prayer. "Man," I said, "you are really something." God was strengthening me in the most broken places and teaching me to embrace a mystery as if it were a friend. Chapter 42. Before Scott's death, I sometimes flew 160,000 miles a year to speak at conferences all over the world. Lisa quit flying with me. She wanted to stay home and enjoy her friends, or at least that's what she said. While Scott bounced from one benefactor to another, Stephen was away at college earning his journalism degree. Elise, then 16, was at home with her mom. In May 2000, I noticed the first clear signs of a destructive pattern in Lisa's drinking. Lisa and I left a three-hour dinner with wine-drinking friends, and on the way to the car, Lisa grabbed my hand to steady herself. A couple of times in the fall, the sound of Lisa falling down awakened me in the middle of the night. I found her passed out on the bathroom floor. She weighed 70 pounds less than me, but still drank the same amount. We drank every night. Deep down, I knew she had a problem. I also knew I had one. But I didn't confront her about it, perhaps because doing so would have forced me to admit that I drank too much wine. Then Scott died. After 6 weeks with John and Nancy, we moved into a rented house. A van brought our furniture and hundreds of bottles of wine from my wine cellar. Lisa cried herself to sleep nearly every night. Every afternoon, she opened her first bottle of wine before she cooked the evening meal. Over the next few months, I lost the rest of my stock market money, and we lived off credit. I earned no money until I went back on the conference circuit in 2002. That summer, as I took my seat on an American Airlines 737, leaving Orange County, California, my cell phone rang. It was Lisa. "Honey, I've got some bad news for you," she said. "Your mom died this morning." We buried her at Rose Hill Cemetery on the east side of Fort Worth. Bobby and her son, Pete, came. Bruce and Philip also came. I stood behind the little lectern at the funeral home and felt fake. I had seen Mom the least in the last 8 years. I couldn't say anything about her that everyone in the room didn't know, but I was the preacher. Everyone expected me to talk. I took 5 minutes to say that Mom was a saint. I still partly believed it. Then we rode up the hill and put Mom's coffin in the ground next to Dad's. I had become close friends with B.J. Weber, one of the chaplains for the New York Yankees, and often stayed in the basement of his Manhattan brownstone. In December 2002, he told me about a former Goldman Sachs partner who had started a men's ministry. "Why don't I cook steaks and get my friend Jim to come over for dinner with us tonight?" B.J. asked. "We'll drink some great wine. Sounds fine to me." That evening, the door burst open. In walked Jim Lane. "Hey," he yelled, throwing his arms around me, slapping me on the back as if we'd been friends forever. "So I hear you're a wine lover," Jim said. "What's your favorite?" I told him. That wine was so rare that I had never seen it in a wine store, only on the wine list of exclusive restaurants in California. "Come to my house and speak to my men's group," he said, "and I'll give you a bottle." He was 51, 3 years younger than me. His hair had turned gray, but he retained the athletic build and ruddy looks of his youth. Blue blood ran through his 5-foot-8-inch frame and mingled with evangelical nobility. When Billy Graham attended Wheaton College, Jim's grandparents directed Graham's spiritual life. Goldman Sachs crowned Jim a partner when he was still in his early 30s. But life as a multimillionaire left him empty. He began to drink too much and cheated on his wife. The shame took its toll. In the early 80s, Jim met B.J., who cared for the street people in Manhattan. Jim wanted to confess what he had done, but he didn't know how B.J. would respond. "I have this friend who," he told B.J. over lunch. B.J. did not act surprised. He did not condemn. He did not offer cliches. He sympathized with the anonymous sufferer. Little by little, Jim revealed that the friend was him. That confession helped Jim find God's forgiveness. It also made him realize he could not pursue God on his own. Like many other men, he didn't care for the traditional church services that featured 45-minute sermons about everything he ought to be doing. So he invited 7 men to come to his house for breakfast on Friday mornings. I pulled up to Jim's snow-covered, 5-acre estate in New Canaan, Connecticut, in February 2003. Jim hugged me as I walked through the front door. "Come into the kitchen," he said. "Get some coffee and breakfast." Jim's caterer had prepared his own version of the Egg McMuffin, which sat next to mounds of pastries, preserves, butter, fresh fruit, and urns of gourmet coffee. Jim shook hands with the new guys and slapped the old guys on the back. Some wore tailored suits and expensive Italian ties. Others had on jeans and down vest and work boots. Soon the place was noisier than a Friday happy hour, but I could hear Jim's distinctive high-pitched laugh 2 rooms away. At 7 a.m., Jim walked through the house and yelled, "Time to start." The 7 men had turned into a crowd of 150 squeezed into a living room dismantled to accommodate them. A 4-piece band, keyboard, drums, and 2 guitars, set up on its stage next to the fireplace and played worship songs. Then Eric Metaxas, a comedian and best-selling author, made announcements that served as a pretext for his jokes. "I want to welcome all the new guys this morning," he said. "In spite of what you may have heard, we are not a cult. However, the mothership will be here at 9 o'clock to take us home to our real planet if you want to go. We've looked forward to this meeting for a long time because we lined up a famous speaker who needs no introduction. Unfortunately, that speaker canceled on us at the last minute. But we were able to replace him with another speaker who needs no introduction. Unfortunately, he also canceled. Unfortunately, the itinerary of everyone we asked to take his place was full. Finally, we found a speaker whose itinerary was open, exceptionally open. Our speaker this morning does require an introduction. He's from Texas." Eric frowned and shrugged. I know, I apologize, but I told you we were in a pinch. His academic resume isn't really very impressive, so I won't embarrass him by mentioning it. He has written some books, which I'm sure none of you have read or will read, so I won't take time to mention them either. I will mention one outstanding achievement. He was a professor at Dallas Theological Seminary. For those of you who don't know, Dallas Seminary is a small, fundamentalistic graduate school somewhere in the South. Maybe Dallas, but I'm not sure. Our speaker had an emotional breakdown. and joined a cult in Southern California, and the seminary fired him. Then Eric said a few endearing things about me, but not a lot. I stood up to speak amid applause and feigned jeers and waited for them to be quiet. "Eric," I said, "thank you for the introduction. You must know how intimidating it is for a Texan to speak to all these educated people, even you who graduated from Yale, a fact you were happy to share with me in the first 5 minutes of our meeting. I know that some of the kind, discerning, intelligent, and truly Christian men in the room may have thought your humor was a bit harsh. And maybe it was. But I want you to know from the bottom of my heart that when someone treats me harshly or mocks me, it is simply my policy to overlook it. I would never draw public attention to the thoughtless use of sarcastic, highbrow humor by a pseudo-intellectual from an Ivy League school, all at my expense. I am sure you are a decent man, and someday they will discover a therapy or a medication that will prove me right." The room filled with applause and laughter. Eric himself roared. "Hey, Eric," someone yelled, "how does it feel to finally get some payback?" Then I opened my Bible and talked for the next 25 minutes about how loving Jesus is the greatest experience in the world. It was just like a young life club for middle-aged men, many of whom were wealthy. It felt like home. Chapter 43. In Fort Worth, I had rebuffed invitations to become the pastor of a church I spoke at regularly on Sunday mornings. It was called New Church, had about 250 people, and was located in a suburb northeast of Fort Worth. My desire to build a super church had resurfaced. New Church seemed to provide the best opportunity for my vision. I took the offer. I renamed the church Wellspring and expected crowds to appear. They did not. I hadn't experienced that kind of failure since my first days of leading a young life club. Each Sunday I returned to the stage with the same resilience, but empty chairs chipped away at my pride. I prayed for the church to grow. And then I prayed some more. I thought God was testing me. I didn't consider that the church wasn't about me, or that instead of asking God to bless my church, I should have asked how my church could bless God. While only 250 people showed up to hear me speak at Wellspring on a Sunday, thousands gathered at conferences where I spoke. On a trip to Cape Town, South Africa in 2004, Lisa disappeared into the airport lounge, only to return tipsy. When we settled into our hotel room, she asked for wine at lunch. I told her no, and we fought over that glass of wine for most of the afternoon. We showed up to dinner with my admin, Aaron, angry at one another. At first, we tossed lighthearted barbs at each other, eliciting laughter from Aaron. But the wine made me mean as I reminisced about other trips. "Honey, remember that vacation in the Philippines," I said, "when the raw fish you had at dinner made you sick? The hotel doctor gave you medicine, but you refused to take it because he was just a hotel doctor. So you spent the next 2 days in bed, and when we landed in L.A., we had to rush you to the emergency room so the doctors who spoke English with an American accent could offer you the exact same diagnosis and the exact same medicine. Only they charged us thousands of dollars for the medicine and the IVs to cure your dehydration." Aaron stopped laughing when he saw the humiliation on Lisa's face. Lisa left the table and stormed down the hall toward our room. I followed her. She wondered out loud if her life would have been better had she married her high school sweetheart. "When I came out of the bathroom," Lisa said, "I'll see you in heaven." "What have you done?" "Nothing. I'll see you in heaven." "Have you taken something?" When she didn't answer, I rushed back into the bathroom and found an empty bottle of sleeping pills. I called the manager, who called for an ambulance. At the hospital, Lisa was groggy and incoherent. The doctors drew blood, decided not to pump her stomach, and then put in IVs. When she came to, she wept and said over and over, "My son shot himself and my husband hates me." I tried to tell Lisa that I loved her and that I was sorry, but she never heard me. Finally, she went to sleep, and I went back to the hotel at 6 a.m. 3 hours later, I dragged myself onto a stage. I told 1,500 people how to hear the voice of God and received a standing ovation. Almost as soon as I stepped away from the stage, the confusion, pain, and terror broke out of the vault into which I had shoved it while I spoke to the crowd. I returned to Lisa in the ICU. Her hair was tangled and soaked in sweat. I bent down to embrace her. "Honey, I am so sorry for being so cruel to you last night," I said. "I'm sorry I put you through all this," she said. "I don't know what happened. I just lost my mind." I persuaded the doctor to release Lisa instead of requiring a stay in the psych ward, which was normal hospital protocol. At the hotel that same day, Lisa again asked for a drink at lunch. A few weeks later, at about 2 in the afternoon, I opened our bedroom door to see Lisa with a glass of wine. "I am losing every bit of affection I have for you," I yelled at her. "Stop drinking in the daytime. Stop drinking behind my back." I headed to the gym to rid myself of rage. In the middle of a bench press, I envisioned her swallowing more sleeping pills. I ran out of the gym and drove home to find her sitting in our bedroom, as though we had never had a fight. "Honey, I'm sorry I screamed at you," I said. "It's okay. I know I scared you." "I'm going to stop drinking," I said. "I want you to stop drinking, too." "I'll stop drinking for you." "That won't work. You have to stop drinking for yourself." "Okay, I'll stop." I put a lock on the cellar door and stopped drinking. In November 2004, 200 men showed up at Jim Lane's New Canaan estate for the Friday morning meeting. But Jim was nowhere to be found. A couple of the guys went upstairs to look for him. His bedroom door was locked. "Go away," yelled Jim. "We're not going away," they said. A few minutes later, a red-eyed, unshaven, hungover Jim opened the door. "I want to die," he said. "That's not an option," said one of the men. "We're all in this together," said another. "Together we'll figure a way out." He had been on a 2-day binge. They talked for hours. The encounter ended with Jim's surrender. "I'll do whatever you say," he said. "I am so sorry." They reserved a room for him at a rehab in Minnesota. Jim did his 28 days and returned home determined to stay sober. Everyone in Jim's Friday morning group, dubbed the New Canaan Society, knew where Jim had been. Had he been the pastor of a church, the board would have fired him. They might have paid for his rehab, but he would have been sent to a new congregation, maybe in another state. But this was not church. This was a few hundred businessmen striving to love Jesus and each other. Jim feared that his rehab stay would destroy the Friday morning meetings. But 300 men, the largest NCS crowd ever, embraced their sober, alcoholic leader with a standing ovation on his first Friday morning back. Chapter 44. In the fall of 2004, both Stephen and Elise were home for the weekend, when again I confronted Lisa for the 100th time about her drinking. "I'm just not ready to stop," she told me. She collapsed in an inebriated heap on the bathroom floor. I brought the kids in, who were now both in their 20s. We implored her for an hour and a half. She insisted she could control her drinking if I would just let up on the pressure. "Is that so?" I asked. "Then why did you try to kill yourself in Cape Town by swallowing all those sleeping pills?" It was the first time our children had heard about her attempted suicide. Lisa screamed at me and took a harmless swing. "You need to go to rehab," I said. "I'm not going to rehab." "Why not?" I asked. "I'm just not," Lisa said. "I'll stop drinking now." We concluded the impromptu intervention with the agreement that if Lisa had one more drink, she would have to start AA or rehab, whichever I chose. The first step of AA's 12 steps says, "We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable." It's also the first step for members of Al-Anon, the support group for the loved ones of alcoholics. I pushed Lisa toward AA, thinking it was the way she would sober up. I wanted her to admit she was powerless, but I was unwilling to admit that I, too, was powerless over her drinking. I remained confident that one way or another, I could get her to put the bottle down. The second step in AA and Al-Anon says, "Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. But to do that, you have to acknowledge that your life is insane," a step I didn't know I needed to take. I saw myself as the enduring husband willing to go to any length to save his wife, and yet my ignorance and arrogance were robbing her of dignity. I had told my wife she had to choose sobriety for herself, and then tried to force her to make that choice. I had treated her like a child and then expected her to make decisions like an adult. In January 2005, we flew to Minneapolis and rented a car for the hour-and-a-half drive north to Center City so Lisa could spend 28 days in a famous rehab there called Hazleton, the same program that Jim had completed. At the intake desk, Lisa wept. The counselor asked Lisa some questions about her drinking. Lisa told her that a couple of weeks ago, she had wandered out of the house in the dead cold of night in a nightgown and barefoot. "If you do that here, you'll freeze to death before we can find you," she said. I stayed the first week and did the family program. At the end of Lisa's first week, I flew home on Saturday. I had visions of her walking out into the sub-zero Minnesota night. I saw myself standing in the Minneapolis airport, watching her body travel up the conveyor belt in a white cardboard coffin. She called me crying for the first few days after I left, and then she calmed down and accepted her fate. Lisa loved meeting with her primary group of 8 women. Under the guidance of a recovered alcoholic, each member of the group told her story to the group. Their meetings were miniature AA meetings. After a couple of weeks, she said to me over the phone, "I wish the church could be more like AA." "What do you mean?" "Well, everyone here is so honest and no one condemns anyone." A day after I brought Lisa home from Hazleton, she went out to lunch and didn't return home. At 5 p.m., I began calling her cell phone. No answer. At 6 p.m., she answered, "Jack, where are you?" "On a freeway." "What freeway?" "I don't know." "Pull off the road now." "I don't want to come home." "You have to pull off the road before you get into a wreck." "I don't want to live." "Please pull off the road now." "Oh, no, there's a cop behind me." "Lisa, pull off the road or you're going to jail." "Okay, I'm parked." "Where are you?" "I'll come get you." "I don't know." "What street are you on?" "I don't see a street sign." "What do you see?" "A fence and airplanes." "Okay, just stay there. I'll find you." The Dallas-Fort Worth airport is huge, covering more than 18,000 acres, a larger landmass than Manhattan. I drove down roads I'd never been on to a section outside the airport I'd never seen, and I saw our black Suburban on the side of the road. Inside, Lisa had passed out. When we got home, I carried Lisa to bed. She was comatose. Worried that her body was shutting down, I called 911. The paramedics took her to the hospital. Her blood alcohol concentration was 0.388. A blood alcohol concentration of 0.4 can be fatal. When she woke up the next morning, she said, "I lost my mind. I will never drink again. Please forgive me." I studied alcoholism even more than I studied grief. If I could understand how the disease worked, I could halt its progress in Lisa, whom I saw less as a person to be loved than as a problem to be fixed. As my knowledge grew, I gave a series of talks about alcoholism at a Wednesday evening class at Wellspring. One was about detaching from your alcoholic. I told people that allowing your well-being to rise and fall on the sobriety of a loved one will only make you miserable. But that was exactly what I was doing. Some people in the church knew that Lisa had spent time in rehab. I'm sure they assumed I spoke from personal experience. Lisa, who sat in the front row, was humiliated. I was oblivious. In July 2006, Lisa traveled with Stephen to help him move into his new loft in St. Louis, where he had taken a job as a reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. That week, Alex, an old friend, came to Fort Worth to preach at my church. He brought along his wife, Mary. It had been years since I had seen them. At 6:30 on Sunday morning, Mary and I sat at our kitchen island drinking coffee. She confided in me that her father had sexually abused her as a teenager. A few years ago, she had taken Alex with her to confront her father, who broke down, admitted what he had done, and apologized. In the 20 years I had known her, it was the first serious conversation we had ever had. "I always thought you were afraid of me," I said. "I was afraid of you," she said. "I was afraid of all men." But the confrontation with her father gave her courage she never thought possible. She went back to work and built a successful company on her own. A photograph of Lisa from when she was in the second grade had vexed me for years. In the black and white picture, bags appear under her eyes. What child has bags under her eyes? After Alex and Mary left, Lisa and I spent a week alone at a farm in the hills of Dorset, Vermont. "You'll never believe what happened to Mary," I said. As I told her Mary's story, she could hear the admiration in my voice. A few nights later, we lay in bed. Lisa confessed that for 7 years of her childhood, her father had regularly sneaked into her bedroom and sexually assaulted her. What she remembered most about grade school was her teacher's rebukes for falling asleep in class after her dad had kept her up at night. The bags I saw in the picture held the secret to her shame. After 32 years of marriage, I'd only begun to understand my wife. Chapter 45. On Saturdays, while her mother was at work and her two brothers played outside, Lisa's father forced her into sex acts before she could go outside. Lisa remembered one night when her mother walked in while her father was abusing her. "Oh, Tommy," she cried. "Get out," the coach yelled. She did. By the time she was 12, Lisa had had enough. When he tried to join her in the shower, she screamed at him. He never tried anything after that. "I'm not good," she had said in the moonlight by the lake when she was 19 years old. 33 years later, I finally understood what that meant. In her mind, she never had any purity to protect, only her shame to conceal. It made sense now. What didn't make sense was why she had never told me. She said, "I didn't think you would want me if you knew what I had done." What she had done? After all these years, she still thought of herself as a co-conspirator, not as a victim. That is part of the power an abuser has over a child. Lisa told me some of the unprintable details, as much as she thought I could tolerate. Now I understood why Lisa was often quiet in social settings. She would walk into a room full of people who were talking and laughing and think, "If these people only knew who I really am, they wouldn't want me in this room." While I had once been confident I could stop her drinking, I had no idea how to repair a soul bludgeoned by years of secret shame. I finally asked for help and learned about a rehab center in Arizona. They treated not only addictions, but also childhood trauma that leads to adult dysfunctions. Lisa was there for 4 weeks before Elisa and I joined her for family week. When I saw Lisa for the first time in 25 days, she looked a decade younger. On the way to our first lecture, we cut through a sea of sweet smiles and floated on arias of, "Hi, Lisa. Hey, Lisa. How you doing, Lisa?" She had become the queen of rehab. For the first time, I was in her shadow. "Jack, this will be a hard week," she said. "Don't worry, honey," I said. "We'll all be fine." But she knew better. From the beginning, one rule was made clear. We weren't to talk about our personal or family issues unless we were in the presence of counselors. We paid for their guidance to resolve issues we couldn't resolve on our own. If we talked about those issues, we risk undoing their work or stymieing it. I violated the rule at our first lunch. Lisa and Elise refused to engage, so we ate in silence. In a session the next day, a counselor asked me, "Do you always interact like that?" "Like what?" "Like that," he said. "I have no idea what you mean. Your tone, your volume, and expression are all angry." He seemed to be insinuating that I was part of Lisa's problem. I didn't appreciate it. I was the victim, not the perpetrator. By the second night, my daughter stopped speaking to me. We met with Lisa's primary group of 7 other residents each day. She loved them. I couldn't stand them. "Jack, when you speak, I hear my father's voice," said a 27-year-old man named Bobby. I didn't know his story, but I knew that what he said to me was not a compliment. The group let out a collective sigh. I wanted to say, "Maybe you should have listened to your father's voice, and then you wouldn't have become a chronic relapser." Instead, I said, "Thank you, Bobby." At a meeting near the end of the week, I looked around the room and realized that everyone had sat in a specific place. Lisa sat in front of me with Elise and 2 counselors. Her primary group was to the left in a semicircle. The meeting was a setup. "Lisa would like to tell you how your anger has hurt her," one of the counselors said. "Would you like to hear it?" It wasn't much of a choice. "Yes," I said. "Okay," she said. "You may respond in 3 ways. You may agree, you may disagree, or you may ask for more information. You cannot argue, justify, excuse, or accuse. This is the time for you to listen. Do you understand the rules?" "Yes." Lisa took out a list. She rattled off the story of her humiliation in church when I talked about detaching from your alcoholic. She couldn't understand how I could be so callous. I was embarrassed at my own insensitivity. "Would you like to respond?" her counselor asked. "It's true," I said. "I'm sorry." And so it went, story after story. Finally, the counselor said, "I think that's enough, Lisa." All I could do was listen and feel sad. The next day, I asked a counselor, "Do you think I could benefit from a week in your trauma program?" The counselor was the one who had diagnosed me as an angry person. Their trauma program offers group therapy that deals with the trauma of a person's early life. "I've already taken the liberty of reserving you a place next Monday morning," he said. Chapter 46. The group therapist asked me to draw a picture from childhood and then to explain it. I took a black marker to butcher paper